that's just Yoda and Naomi Prince. Goldman Sachs formerly worked for them. She really understands an awful lot of these areas in a very insider way. So let's give a listen, because I really...
We should try to do that so that we prevent this from rebubbling up again. And, like, it's astonishing to me that those conversations are really not taking place in Congress.
No, and we're talking about banks. Now, I realize that we have to redefine what a bank is. Goldman Sachs, and we're all just thrilled they have paid back what they were loaned. And maybe you should discuss that. But how did Goldman Sachs become a bank holding company?
Well, yeah, a bank holding company, you know, is a term that effectively was supposed to represent banks that the head banks that dealt with people's services, you know, for example, checking and savings accounts, giving out simple loans, you know, dealing with just the normal day-to-day financial activities of most people. And they're normally also called commercial banks, but those commercial banks are officially part of this title called bank holding company, which can do these services. And so when Goldman Sachs asked to become a bank holding company, even though it really doesn't deal with real individuals and, you know, normal people's checking or savings accounts or simple loans, they did so because they needed access to money. They needed access to capital. It was last September 21st. They were really scared they would become like their compatriot Lehman Brothers, which had just gone bankrupt because it didn't have enough capital to support its risk and all the things it had done. And they didn't want the same fate to happen to them, so they went to the Fed and said, we want to be a bank holding company, which meant implicitly they would then receive more government support. They would be of the category of banks that could then have a legal call on government support. And the government, more particularly the Federal Reserve, said, okay, fine, no problem. You can become a bank holding company. And as a result, they did, and so did Morgan Stanley at the same time, another investment bank. And as a result of that, they were able to get a lot more federal funding. They were able to access the Federal Reserve to this day and, like, you know, forever, basically, as long as they stay a bank holding company, even though that was really never the intent of what a bank holding company was supposed to do. It's not like Goldman, you know, it deals with the general population.
Well, hey, how do you and I get ourselves declared as a bank holding company? I want to be
in
on this game.
Exactly.
but you know, I realized, you know, I was looking at TERP, and I really wasn't paying attention to the biggest bank in town, the Fed. And so, you know, that when Goldman Sachs says they paid back what they were, quotes, loaned, we're looking at TERP funds, but we really aren't looking what the Fed has done. And so a very big part of your book is discussing, so we can understand the Fed. So tell us the Fed's role in Goldman Sachs and so many other of these huge conglomerates, how they have survived.
Well, you know, how the Fed survives or how the bank...
No. How Goldman Sachs and others, I want the Fed's role in bankrolling their, money.
The Fed had a tremendous role because the Fed was able to open what they call facilities, which are basically, you know, credit unions for the big banks, where banks could put up, you know, very questionable collateral, and we don't know to this day what they actually put up in return for very, very cheap, like 0 to 0.25% interest rate loans from the Federal Reserve that were made on offer during this crisis period and are still on offer to the banking system. And as a result, it meant that banks who didn't have enough money, not only were they getting some bailout money from TARP, but they were also able to access the Federal Reserve to the tune of, you know, potentially trillions of dollars. Again, the Fed continues to refuse to disclose this information exactly. But as a result, you know, they could keep doing what they were doing, and they had the Federal Reserve's money effectively backing them, and they still do. And as a result, they've been able to post now record profits again. Goldman Sachs had its second biggest quarter ever just now. Its second quarter, the prior quarter of 2009, was a record quarter. You know, they're back to trading. They're back to taking risks. They're back to posting record profits and bonuses. J.P. Morgan Chase, another bank that received a lot of government subsidies, including for its acquisition of Bear Stearns back in March of last year, which, you know, the Fed had no business sponsoring. I mean, you know, when banks normally merge and acquire other banks, you know, they take the risk. The government doesn't take the risk. But in these situations, all that went out the window, and the Fed stepped in and basically took everyone's risk and extended all of this money. And they had a tremendous, tremendous role in reshaping the banking landscape to what it is now. And what it is now is, you know, like we're talking about, Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley are bank holding companies with rights to public money. J.P. Morgan Chase has now acquired Bear Stearns and Washington Mutual, which was was classified as a savings and loan bank, but it had been a bank that J.P. Morgan had wanted to buy for years, and it took advantage of the crisis and federal sponsorship to do so. Wells Fargo merged with Wachovia. Big one, Bank of America merged with Merrill Lynch, and Merrill Lynch was a complete mess. I mean, Merrill Lynch was about to fall apart last fall when the decision was made to allow it to merge into Bank of America, which, you know, is the kind of a bank that deals more with individuals and, you know, those whole checking and savings accounts and the boring sort of commercial bank activities. And so now we have a situation all Fed blessed. The Fed could have said no to any of this. And instead, they were like, yes, bring it on. So the Fed has a tremendous role in what is currently the situation. There are people that think, including, I believe, Krugman, but that people at the Fed did the right thing, that Ben Bernanke avoided a Great Depression by doing all of these maneuvers. And I personally think what he did was deflect it maybe into the future a little bit. But at the end of the day, we have a more concentrated banking landscape. We've got more powerful banks. They're floated on public money, and they're taking more risk, while consumer credit problems and mortgage problems and unemployment problems continue to rise on the other side. So there's no way that's a more stable situation for real. It just kind of looks that way right now.
Well, and you said the specific person, Ben Bernanke, he made the decision. This is a democracy.
Exactly. He made the decision. Now, Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson was there at the time. There are other people involved, but just the way the Federal Reserve is set up, it's really him and the board members of the Fed, actually, that of which he's the chairman, who make the decision as to whether or not they can grant bank holding company status to certain institutions, whether mergers can be approved. All of that is officially under the Fed's job. And so when they make those decisions, you know, he's the chairman of the Fed. He has tremendous power at the Fed. If he had, like, stepped up and said, no, this is horrible, this is awful, this is going to cause a catastrophe later on, then, you know, maybe it wouldn't have happened. But the fact is, he didn't do that. He was completely fine with the idea of doing what he did, and as a result, again, those banks are doing better right now. I mean, if you get enough federal help, anybody does better. But it's not to me, and I don't believe it's real or lasting.
Well, this is another very valuable asset of your book, because I didn't know that much about the Fed. I mean, I knew it was very controversial when it was first formed, and I know it's been controversial. But frankly, when I read how Lucy Goosey, saving and loan, sure, you know, AIG, you know, they took over a little SNL, and that's how they got all the bailouts. And I thought, well, there's something really bad here, because this is an insurance company of last resort, but it's really not, because
right.
Ben Bernanke makes sure that all of our money is actually giving the insurance as the last resort. And I'm
right.
Sorry that, to me, you know, when we're looking at this, because, you know, frankly, this is still in our memory of Enron, dot-coms, all this kind of, you know, collapses we've had all along. This is just the last one. And when we're looking at the last resort, so to speak, this man and this individual and this board making these kind of conditions, which profoundly affect all of us, except we're not getting any relief, I think that needs to be on the table, looked at now also.
No, I think you're right. I mean, just starting with the last thing you said, that we're not getting any relief while all this other money is being funneled out is a tremendous problem, because not only is it a problem for us as the public, it's a problem for the general stability of the economy, because if unemployment's rising and foreclosures are rising and defaults are a problem and everybody isn't getting the kind of credit extension or help to renegotiate any of those credit problems, it continues to feed into a decline in the general economy, even though banks are doing better and the stock market is doing better on the back of all of the government subsidies. And that's really a big part of my book, is to just kind of show what we're dealing with here. You know, the bailout didn't have to happen as it did. We didn't have to give, you know, Goldman Sachs the money that they did, the backing to J.P. Morgan Chase, certainly the AIG situation. AIG, you know, as you mentioned, is classified as a savings and loan company. It's classified as a bank. So, I mean, it had the official right, sort of, to get government help when it did. And, of course, the government fell over itself to give that help. But you know, technically, it had that access because of how it was classified. And I think, you know, there's a lot of that nitty-gritty that, you know, we don't think about every day. No one knows this. This isn't something that people going to work and driving around and caring for children and parents and everything else really need to consider or should in their lives. But it is, there are distinctions that really do impact where federal money goes. And that impacts where it doesn't go as well. And those are the things that do impact us.
Well, and I think the great thing, and again, we're talking to Nomi Prince, and the book we're talking about, It Takes a Pillage, that, you know, that it seems that the real bottom line, and I don't really mean to oversimplify this because I don't pretend to be an economist at all, but the very bottom line, what these big guys, these really fat cats, really need to do is have any tangential connection to real money, the kind of money that you and I, people actually do things, make things, live in the real life. We need real money. But the big game in town is this super money, if you will, which is virtual. But at the bottom line, they're trying to make that virtual game they have played, which is beyond me, because to me, they don't make anything. Frankly, they don't really have money. They just make it money by being somehow cooking into us that have the real money. And to me, this has just been a colossal collapse, which to me challenges the very edifice of this country. And if we aren't willing to at least look at it,